Well, it is a delight to be back with y'all again today. I enjoy this service look forward to being with you again in the future, and always good to have the opportunity to share Christian fellowship with you. I'm concluding my series on Luther and the Reformation, and today I'm going to talk about Luther's legacy to the Christian world. So I'm moving on from Luther himself to talk about the legacy of Lutheran churches and Lutheran involvement in the ecumenical movement and so forth. I've been faking you out the whole time. That picture up there is nothing in Germany. That's Oxford. I just have a limited range of photos that I use, and I'm always scared about using somebody else's pictures because of all the copyright issues. So if you thought that was Germany, fine. But it's not. I will say maybe it's appropriate to talking about Luther and the wider Christian world, because Oxford has so often been the center of renewal in English-speaking Christianity. John Wesley took his start there, and the Oxford or Tractarian movement of the 1800s got its start there, and so forth. Been asked one question about Luther that I thought I should address. And that's the question about Luther's anti-Semitism, or to be specific, his anti-Judaism. I'm afraid that's true. There's no getting around it. A couple of things we can say about that. When Luther was studying the Hebrew Bible, we should say the Hebrew and Aramaic Bible, you know, which book of the Bible is not written in Hebrew, for the most part, of the Old Testament? It's Daniel, that's right. Daniel mostly is written in Aramaic, so we speak of the Hebrew and Aramaic scriptures that are our Old Testament, the Jewish Tanakh, the Jewish writings that they revere as scripture. But when Luther was studying that and working on his translation of the Old Testament, he was in contact with rabbis and seems to have had cordial relationships with Jewish rabbis. Something changed along the way as the reforming movement went on. I've said to you that Luther could change his mind in the middle of a book several times. Luther's mind changed on a lot of things, and at some point he became strongly anti-Jewish, strongly, you know, what today we would probably call anti-Semitic. It's anti-Jewish if you're referring to opposition to Judaism as a religious system, anti-Semitic if you associate it with a kind of racial identification. But my understanding is that many of Luther's writings express strongly anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic sentiments, and that might be a part of a negative legacy that was inherited in the German-speaking world and could even account for 20th century events. However, Lutheran theologians like to point out that the places where he expressed his anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism are not in the parts of his writings that are considered doctrinally binding upon Lutherans. And so they say that's Luther, but that's not part of Lutheranism, not something that they are bound to. And Lutheran groups like the Lutheran World Federation have uniformly condemned anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism and worked together with Jews and others to try to overcome some of the prejudices that have existed in the past. But it's a very good question, and I'm glad that somebody posed that question to me. So today I want to move on to talk about the legacy that Luther left to the Christian world. One of the largest legacies is the legacy of Lutheran churches. Probably wherever you have been, you have encountered Lutheran churches. In Texas, they tend to be centered around the Hill Country and Central Texas, where a large number of Lutheran immigrants came to Texas in the 1860s and 70s and beyond, largely as a result of the Franco-Prussian War. I know this story because it's part of our family story. My wife's father is from a Lutheran Central Texas family. Now, he grew up in a place called Rosebud. If y'all know where Rosebud is in Falls County, Texas. What was it? Born in Rosebud. Okay. All right. Well. Sure. My wife's father was born there, and born into a German-speaking Lutheran family. They spoke no language but German around the house until each kid was 6 years old, and when they turned six, they spoke only English to the children so they could get them ready to go to the public schools there. But my wife learned a few little German phrases, and she learned the chants that they used in the Lutheran churches that that my wife's parents attended. In fact, I'll show you a photo related to that. What happened then was not that a Lutheran church was founded after Martin Luther. That's one of the mistaken ideas that I have to explain to my students. It was a much, much more complicated process. Europe was divided into kingdoms and principalities and duchies and free imperial cities, and eventually what happens is that the Holy Roman Empire, represented in that age by the great Emperor Charles V, was simply not able to rein in all of the movements for religious freedom, and various of these kingdoms and duchies and principalities and free imperial cities decided that they would go with Luther's version of the Reformation or Calvin's version of the Reformation, or perhaps simply allow a degree of religious toleration. One of them, the Elector of Hesse, actually allowed for the toleration of Anabaptists, but that was very, very unusual. Most people in this age took the idea that we encapsulate in the Latin expression cuius regio, eius religio, whose region, his religion. And that doesn't mean everybody gets the chance to choose. Wrong. It means the leading person, the king, the prince of that region, determines what the religion is going to be in that particular area. Many of them elected to remain with Catholicism, especially in the more southern areas of German-speaking areas. There is no such thing as Germany until very late in the 1800s, as a matter of fact. So all of these rulers are making decisions about what form of religion is going to prevail. The idea of religious toleration was not widespread. Like I say, the Elector of Hesse was one of the very few people who sponsored something like an idea of religious toleration. Most of them took the view that a nation has to have one and only one form of religious belief to hold it together culturally, and that to allow differing forms of religious belief was dangerous to the fabric of the nation itself. Okay, so it's not going to be until much, much later, until around the time of John Wesley, that European countries like Holland and England are going to be experimenting with the idea of religious toleration. But in this period, various kings and princes and dukes and others, or city councils of free imperial cities, are deciding that they will take up Luther's idea of reform. First of all, in the areas where people were speaking German, the areas that we would probably call Germany, Austria, and Switzerland today, where some areas became Lutheran. But because it was different principalities and areas, many of them took different forms of Lutheranism, some leaning strongly towards Catholicism, some leaning strongly against the traditional Catholic practices in the churches. So Lutheranism is a many splendored thing. Have you ever heard that old song from the 60s? Lutheranism is a... Nah, that's not the way it went, I think. But it's a truth, I think. Lutheranism has a great deal of variety as it spread throughout the world. In fact, one of the ways in which Lutheranism spread was that many of the leaders of Nordic countries came to embrace Lutheranism as their state churches. I mean, what today is Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland. Now, I learned something a few years ago. In around 1998 or 99, I was invited as a representative of the National Council of the Churches of Christ in the United States. That's the largest ecumenical organization in the United States. To be a representative to meet together with the Nordic Ecumenical Council. And there were four of us from the United States. Two of us were ELCA Lutherans. I'll explain that in a little bit. Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. That's the largest Lutheran denomination in the United States. Christ Lutheran Church on Lover's Lane is an ELCA denomination. So two of our delegation were ELCA Lutherans, and two of the delegation were myself and an Anglican. So we had a Methodist, an Anglican, and two Lutherans. And the folks in Sweden, where we were meeting, and from all these Nordic countries, were a little puzzled. They say, oh, this is very interesting, an ecumenical meeting with a Methodist and an Anglican. And we thought, what's interesting about that? And what we learned is that the Nordic Ecumenical Council is where Swedish Lutherans meet Norwegian Lutherans and Finnish Lutherans and Danish Lutherans. Now that's what they meant by ecumenical, and typically the Methodists and Anglicans had not been part of that. Methodists and Anglicans are very small groups in these Nordic countries. Now, why Nordic and not Scandinavian? I learned something there as well. Finns are not considered to be Scandinavian, but they are considered to be Nordic. So when you draw the circle at Nordic, it includes the Finnish Lutherans as well as the Swedish and the Norwegian and the Danish Lutherans as well. So Lutheranism begins spreading to the Nordic countries with a strong part, a strong region of Northern Europe then becoming Lutheran. Lutheran churches tended to have strong agreement in doctrine. If nothing else, they agreed to the Augsburg Confession of Faith. That was that confession that was drawn up in Augsburg in 1530. You remember I said Luther was not present, and in fact his leading theologian, Philip Melanchthon, had been present at Augsburg, and the deal was Luther was bombastic. Did you get that from my last view? If he had been tweeting, he would have been a dangerous tweeter, right? I mean, they would have tried to give him a chief of staff to rein him in and his tweeting and so forth. But Philip Melanchthon was much more a kind of reconciling figure. And so the Augsburg Confession is actually a very ecumenical document, and it begins by stating what is it that we hold in common with other Christians, by which they really mean Catholics, and then not a section on where we differ with Catholics, but areas where we raise questions. You see the way Melanchthon puts it? He's much more diplomatic in his way of putting things. And for that reason, the Augsburg Confession has been favored not only by Lutherans, but used by some other Christian groups because of its irenic tone. That unites almost all Lutherans together. In Latin, it's Confessio Augustana. So if you ever see a college named Augustana College or a university called Augustana University, you can bet that's a Lutheran institution, just like Aldersgate and Epworth are going to be Methodist institutions. Sort of sacred words for those particular folks. There were several decades in which Lutheran theologians battled out very particular differences in doctrine. And by the 1550s, most of the Lutheran churches, now again, remember there's this great diversity of churches, most of the churches had agreed on a book full of doctrinal statements that they called the Book of Concord, Liber Concordiae. So another favored Lutheran word, a sort of sacred, heartwarming word. This is like if you want to impress your Lutheran friends, just say Augustana or Concordia. Concordia is one of those big Lutheran words that makes their hearts just leap and dance and so forth. Garrison Keillor talks about one of the elements of Lutheran unity, at least in Minnesota, is something called tuna hot dish that they seem to have at all of their gatherings. But it is, I have to point out, it is not actually mentioned in the Book of Concord. I think it was a later development of Lutheran unity. Strong agreement in doctrine, and in the past, Lutheran churches tended to take a very strict view that they were the church intended by Jesus Christ, and they had purified themselves from certain Catholic excesses, but that the rest of us really needed to get on board and recognize that Lutherans had the correct doctrine. And there were a lot of Lutheran books that we would call polemical books in the past, sort of aiming to show why the Catholics were wrong, why the Methodists were wrong, why the Baptists were wrong, and why the Lutherans were right, but mostly in the area of doctrine. That was where Lutheran unity was strongest between all of these separated Lutheran churches. A lot less agreement in liturgy, that is to say forms of worship, and in forms of church government. So some Christian traditions are actually characterized by a form of church government. When we use the word episcopal, that means it has to do with a bishop, an episcopus. And episcopal with a lowercase e means church government governed by bishops. All right? Our predecessors in the United Methodist Church were called the Methodist Episcopal Church and the Methodist Episcopal Church South because we had bishops. And there are existing churches that are called the African Methodist Episcopal Church, African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, and the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. That's an episcopal form of church government. Another form of church government is Presbyterian with a lowercase p. That means the church is governed by a representative assembly that includes both lay elders and clergy who are ordained. Actually, they even, in Presbyterian churches, they ordain their lay elders to the office of elder in the church. I always use an example of that. A guy who spoke here last fall, I believe, he was one of the astronauts, help me with his name, a Presbyterian, a very active Presbyterian layman, Buzz Aldrin. Thank you very much. Well done. I follow him on Twitter ever since that time. But Buzz Aldrin, do you remember what he did on the first mission to the moon? While they were having a quiet time, Buzz Aldrin pulled out wine and bread that he had brought for the occasion and consecrated them. And he, as an elder of the Presbyterian Church, celebrated the Lord's Supper as they were parked on the surface of the moon. One of the churches down in the area south of Houston where NASA is has an annual, every year in June, Lunar Eucharist to celebrate that particular event when the Lord's Supper was celebrated on the moon. I think that's totally cool. I mean, I was the one in my elementary school that they called the astro nut, you know, so I'm very much into stuff like that. If I'd got an ask a question at that meeting here at Highland Park, I'd have asked him about the Lunar Eucharist and what's going on with that. But that's a Presbyterian form of church government, and whether you're church title has Presbyterian in it, that idea of being governed by a body of elders, of presbyters, is one form of church government. Then another form of church government is simply called congregational. That means where every congregation is independent of other congregations. They may meet together in some kind of representative assemblies, but they're not binding on congregations. The churches that we historically called congregational, now part of the United Church of Christ in the United States, but Baptist congregations are traditionally congregational in their government. What I'm saying, though, is that Lutherans didn't agree on a form of church government. So there are some Lutheran churches throughout the world that are, in fact, episcopal. And that's typically true of the Scandinavian or the Nordic Lutheran churches, where they have bishops who are still in the cathedrals that had been established as Catholic cathedrals way back in the Middle Ages, just like Anglican bishops in England preside in the cathedrals that had been established as Catholic cathedrals there. There are Lutheran churches that are governed by representative assemblies. That's true of the ELCA church in the United States, though they also have bishops that play a central role in governing their churches. And there are Lutheran churches that are practically congregational, with some restrictions on what congregations can do. But the denomination that we call the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the United States is an example of a more congregationally oriented Lutheran denomination. Great difference in worship. If you go to some Lutheran churches, you would swear that you were in a Catholic church. As a matter of fact, their worship retains a great deal of historic Catholic tradition. But other Lutheran churches are much more kind of reformed in their orientation. When I went to Christ Lutheran Church for their annual Maundy-Thursday communion service a few years ago, we were very much impressed with how laid back and familiar it seemed to Methodists. So you will find a great deal of variety in Lutheran churches in that respect as well. Lutheranism spread to the United States very early on. Pennsylvania and Northern Maryland, and there's not much more of Maryland than Northern Maryland, became foci. I know I lived there for a little while, but they became foci for German-speaking groups to settle in the United States, and that meant not just Lutherans, but German Reformed churches and various groups of Mennonites and other Anabaptists and so forth. Pennsylvania became that sort of focus area early on, and a lot of Lutheran synods were organized. That means really kind of like mini denominations. One of the things I discovered a few years ago when I did a book called The Sky is Falling, The Church is Dying, and Other False Alarms, was I went back through the 20th century to track the numbers, the membership of denominations that now make up some of the mainline churches in the United States. And the farther back you get, the more complicated it is, because like if you go United Methodist Church today, but if you want their membership in 1950, you've got to get the membership of the Methodist Church and the Evangelical United Brethren Church that later united. And if you go back to 1925 with the United Methodist, you've got to get the Methodist Episcopal Church, the Methodist Episcopal Church South, the Methodist Protestant Church, the Evangelical Church, and the United Brethren Church, all of which eventually came together to form the UMC. But the winners in terms of how many predecessor denominations that they were the Lutherans, because it looked to me like every other street corner in Minneapolis back in 1900 had a different evangelical Lutheran synod as a kind of mini denomination there. But many, many of those would eventually come together into different denominations with names like Lutheran Church in America or American Lutheran Church. Those were two different groups, and so forth. There is a unique case in the United States of a denomination that is called the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Any of you got LCMS relatives? Okay, LCMS is different. If you go to, we went to my wife's aunt's LCMS church in Sweetwater, Texas, and she was very gentle about this, but made it very clear that when they came to communion, we were not going to be invited to share communion with the LCMS church. There is a reason for that, though, and it's a very particular historical reason. In 1830, in the state of Prussia in northern Germany, what's now northern Germany, the King of Prussia decided that the Lutheran churches and the Reformed churches, those were churches kind of like Presbyterians that went back to John Calvin and his reforms in Geneva, he decided that those and decreed that those churches should be united together. He had been working on that as one of his great projects for many, many years. And at that point, he simply decreed that every legal church in Prussia was going to be a part of that united church. There are still united churches in northern Germany today. But the strongly Lutheran groups in Prussia could not abide that. They would not go into a union with Reformed churches. They petitioned the government to ask if they could be accepted, be given an exception to that rule. The government said, absolutely not. You will either be part of this united church or you will leave Prussia. They chose to leave Prussia. And in fact, they got on board ships that left, and they crossed the Atlantic, and they entered the Mississippi at New Orleans and came up to St. Louis and got off the ships there and founded a new group, very different than other Lutheran groups, called the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Missouri Synod because they began their American journey in St. Louis. That's the group that absolutely would not compromise with any other denominations, and that's been part of the character of the LCMS since its beginning. Now, I do have to tell you that because the LCMS is more congregationally organized, it varies greatly from which one congregation to another as to how strict they are. I mean, there's another group in the United States called the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. There's a Wisconsin church over on Audelia Road, and they have the reputation of being even more kind of hyper-Lutheran than the Missouri Synod. You know, I had a friend who grew up in the Missouri Synod, and she said it wasn't as bad as people represented in terms of doctrinal strictness. Her grandmother always said, "Well, Elaine, when you get to heaven, you'll realize that you were wrong and we were right all along." But she meant she was going to get to heaven anyway, despite her errors in doctrine. My friend Frederick Herzog at Duke Divinity School, leading theologian whose family had grown up in the Missouri Synod church. Frederick used to talk about having Thanksgiving dinner with his Missouri Synod and Wisconsin Synod relatives together in one household. And he said at one point every year, without any signal that he ever saw, they simply went into two different rooms to say the prayer for Thanksgiving. And he said, you know, the scripture is, you shall have no fellowship with unfruitful works of darkness. And that's the way they tended to regard each other in that time. Now, what I have to tell you, though, is that this huge variety of Lutheran synods in the United States, apart from Missouri and Wisconsin, began to coalesce into denominations, more larger denominational clusters in the middle of the 20th century, Lutheran Church in America, American Lutherans, and so forth. And eventually, in the 1980s, they will form the largest Lutheran denomination in the United States, that's the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Note that for Lutherans, the term evangelical does not mean revivalistic, infallible scriptures, that sort of thing. It really means Protestant. It's their term. Evangelisch in German really means, it really means the gospel in its very basis, but it eventually means Protestant-leaning churches. And they formed that denomination in the United States. Here's an American Lutheran confirmation class in Milam County, Texas, at a tiny little community of German-speaking and English-speaking folks called Sharp. Anybody been to Sharp, Texas? Not a hand in the house. I'm not surprised. It took us a long time to find it, but that's where my wife's grandparents both grew up, and that's her grandfather right there. And there's the Herr Pastor, the Lutheran pastor, and you see that book that each of them is holding. That's Martin Luther's Small Catechism. Now, they had to learn that book from one end to the other, and when they were confirmed, they were examined over the contents of the catechism. They stood up in front, and the Herr Pastor would ask them questions, specific questions out of the catechism, and they had to be prepared to give the memorized answer to that. But by 1923, now his confirmation was August 5th, 1923, and we know because we have his confirmation certificate. Very elaborate floral thing that tells you how much Lutherans value baptism and confirmation and marriages, where they all have these very elaborate certificates that they would prepare. We've got the date on it. When her grandmother was confirmed in 1919, 4 years before her future husband was, she was a bit of, you know, she was going after the the younger guys, you know, what do you say, you know, cougar, yeah, she's one of those kind of, no, in those days, you know, I'm not sure that was, there weren't that many eligible Lutherans to marry in Sharp, Texas area, I think, in that time. But when she was confirmed in 1919, she had to learn the catechism both in English and in German, because they didn't know who was going to be conducting the service. As a result of World War I and very strong anti-German prejudice during World War I, most of the Lutheran churches stopped having services in German and began having services in English only, because they thought that would look more American, though they all continued, most of them continued to speak German in their households, which was the case with these families. By the time Carl Adolf, that's his name, that's going to be a problem in World War II, having the name Carl Adolf. By the time Carl Adolf was confirmed on August the 5th, 1923, they were speaking English only in their churches and learning the catechism only in English. So there's a representation for you of a Lutheran community in Central Texas in 1923. Well, I want to talk about the Catholicity of Lutheranism. In that picture there, you might see someone you'll recognize. Because a few years ago, the United Methodist Church entered into a full communion agreement with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. That's an agreement. You know, it used to be that we tried to come up with church unions, and those got to be so cumbersome and difficult that we eventually scrapped that idea and said, we're going to remain in our denominations, but we will recognize each other as fully Christian. And we have done that with the ELCA denomination. 2008, we fully approved that concordat that we have with the ELCA Church. That means they fully recognize our sacraments and our ministries, and there are provisions by which an ELCA minister can serve in the United Methodist Church, and a Methodist elder like myself or you could serve in the ELCA denomination. I told my friend, Bishop Kevin Canals, whom you see there, that one of my ecumenical aspirations has always been to preside at the Lord's table in a Lutheran church. And he grinned and said, I can work that out for you. He was in the very last weeks of his ministry as bishop of the Northern Texas, Northern Louisiana Mission Synod of the ELCA Church. And what he did was that at their annual synod, which would be like the annual conference, he got me to stand with him, and I actually celebrated the Lord's Supper with him there carefully, so he could whisper in my ear, not that side, but this side, or move over here or something like. So I got the cues all, you know how we need that kind of help, getting the cues correct and so forth. April 22nd, 2016. That really was a big deal for me, sort of living out that full communion agreement that we have with the ELCA Church. I'm a little disappointed, I have to tell you, that part of our agreement was that in all future ELCA ordinations, United Methodist bishops will be present, and in all future United Methodist ordinations, ELCA bishops will be present as a sign that we recognize the ministries of each other's churches. I have not yet attended a United Methodist confirmation in which an ELCA bishop was actually present, so I'm concerned that that's not fully gone into effect. But Luther did not really see himself as a separated Christian. He saw himself as a Catholic Christian, at least in the lowercase c use of that word that we use in the Apostles' Creed when we say we believe in the Holy Catholic Church. In the Acts of the Apostles, there's a verse that says, and the church grew and was edified throughout all of Judea in Samaria. And where it says throughout all of Judea and Samaria, the word there is katholis, throughout the whole, katholis. That's the root of the word Catholic. It means throughout the whole, and eventually katholistis ecumenis, throughout the whole of the world. Luther believed that really there is only one church. He didn't want to be a dividing figure in the history of the Christian church. For example, when he taught Christians in his smaller catechism, which my wife's Lutheran grandparents learned in those events that you saw depicted there. Lutheran teaches what you do every morning and every evening. And he says what a Christian does is you make a sign of the cross. You say the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer. You say the Apostles' Creed, both of which we did in this morning service today. And then you say a special prayer appropriate to the morning or the evening, a prayer for God's guidance through the day or a prayer for God's protection through the night. That's just very common Christian stuff. In ecumenical circles in recent years, Lutherans and Catholics together have recognized the Catholicity of the Augsburg Confession. Catholics haven't recognized it as a fully Roman Catholic document. It's not approved for Catholics to use, but they appreciate the Irenic nature of it. Lutheranism has been deeply involved in the ecumenical movement, and the most important outward and visible sign of that was that in 1999, on October the 31st, that year's celebration of Reformation Day, the date on which Luther posted the 95 Theses. Now, I have to tell you this. This is one of those history nerd things. We don't think he actually posted those theses on the door of the church or the door of the castle church, as we always said in the past. That turns out to be one of those historical truisms for which no one can find any evidence. Historians can never say something didn't happen. We just have to say there's no evidence that he actually tacked up those theses on October 31st. But he made public those theses for debate on October 31st. It was very significant that Pope John Paul II on that date traveled to Augsburg, the site of the Augsburg Confession, and signed an agreement with the Lutheran World Federation that we call the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification. And it is a very important Catholic-Lutheran agreement on that most critical doctrine in the time of the Reformation. And it says basically what our churches teach, we teach in common. The Catholics say we don't want to say justification by faith alone because we think works are important as you continue as a Christian. Lutherans said, yes, we think works are important as you continue as a Christian, but initially justification is by faith alone, so we're going to say faith alone. So there are points of disagreement within that document, but a very important ecumenical consensus there. As a matter of fact, so significant that one Lutheran theologian that I know, deeply bred in the traditions of Lutheranism, felt that as a result of that agreement, there was no reason for him to continue being a Lutheran in a separate church. And my colleague Bruce Marshall joined the Catholic Church then as a result of that joint declaration. But more than that, in the summer of 2006, the World Methodist Council met in Seoul, Korea, and the World Methodist Conference became a signer of that joint declaration on the doctrine of justification, with our own little notations about the points at which we would like to speak about works and faith and so forth being in relationship to each other. I've already spoken about the ELCA, United Methodist Full Communion Agreement. That's also an expression of that church's commitment to ecumenical relations. One thing we should say is the Catholic Church went through its own Reformation during the 1500s. Now, we used to use a naughty Protestant word to describe it, and that was the Counter-Reformation. The idea we had as Protestants was we got reformed, and the Catholics tried to stop the church from being reformed. But that's not the truth. The truth is the Catholic Church itself went through a very significant Reformation in that point and has gone through significant reformations since then. If any of you remember what Catholicism was before the Second Vatican Council, when only Latin was used in services and so forth, from the perspective of old-fashioned Catholics, they thought they were just becoming Protestant in the 1960s. Their services were conducted in English from that point, with sermons taking on a much more central role in the services. But ongoing ideas of reform and renewal in Christian communities since the Second Vatican Council. John Wesley was obviously influenced by Martin Luther. When John Wesley had his Aldersgate Street conversion experience, it happened while someone was reading from Martin Luther's preface to his commentary on Romans, where Luther is talking about that central idea in the book of Romans that our salvation is by faith and by grace and not by anything that we do. And at that point, John Wesley gave up his attempt at self-salvation and relied solely on God's grace and said, "I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ alone for my salvation." And part of that insight that Wesley had came from Martin Luther. But perhaps the greatest legacy that Luther left to the church, I would say, is the witness of the saints. I had a conversion experience in January 1970 as a result of a lay witness mission at my home church in Beaumont. I went to Methodist summer camp at Lakeview Methodist Assembly in Palestine, Texas, that summer, and everybody was talking about a Lutheran theologian named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who had been executed in May 1945 by the Nazis for his heroic stand for Christian faith and opposition to Hitler and what the Nazis were standing for, including his opposition to the Holocaust. I realized many years later that that summer of 1970, that May of 1970, had been the 25th anniversary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's execution, and that's why I think all of the Christians were celebrating that occasion. There are rumors going around that this coming October 31st, in about 2 weeks now, the Pope will make a dramatic gesture about Luther, like declare that he's a saint. I doubt it myself. Actually, the Pope that we have now, Pope Francis, went to an international meeting of Lutheran theologians last year on October 31st, and there's a famous photo of him embracing the Lutheran primate of Sweden, who is a woman bishop in that church, and that was an important reconciliation itself. I've always thought that if the Pope ever acknowledges one Protestant saint, it's going to be a Lutheran, but not Luther himself, and maybe not Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I've always thought it might be Johann Sebastian Bach, whose work has always been so beloved in Catholic as well as Protestant churches. But it was the observation of Pope John Paul II that we come together in our saints. When he witnessed the monument to the Catholic and the Anglican martyrs of Uganda, he said, "It's hard for us to remain separated on earth when we recognize that holiness crosses our boundaries and there are saints in other Christian communities." I think that's the great witness that Lutherans and other churches have made to us. So we rejoice in God's saints. We rejoice in the fellowship of the saints. I apologize for keeping you a little long this morning, but let's sing and celebrate our unity in Christ.